Hello, and thanks for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk to stay updated with the latest episodes. There's also my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where I post show notes and other interesting links. There's a special deal for Turkey Book Talk podcast listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that deal, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent topical books published by Hearst. Excitingly, there's a new addition to the offer, the great renowned sociologist Olivier Roy's brand new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State, which has just been published. All the other books on the list, available at cut price, are written by authors who have featured on this podcast. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. To order any of those titles for a third off the original price, which is cheaper than Amazon, follow the link that I post on armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, which will take you to the special page for the deal. And that link is also in the show notes of this episode on iTunes, Podbean, etc. So do consider taking advantage of that offer and in that way help support the podcast. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from Turkey Book Talk, is via my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. You can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now on with this latest episode, and in it I speak to Basharat Peer. He's a staff editor at the New York Times and the author of a new book, A Question of Order, India, Turkey and the Return of Strongmen, which is published by Columbia Global Reports. The book is a slim but stimulating study of the contemporary political situation in India and Turkey. In both countries, populist nationalist governments are reshaping the landscape. In India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is riding a wave of Hindu nationalist fervour, belligerent and uncompromising, promising his supporters national glory and global power. Turkey, of course, has its own strongman, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Peer grew up in Indian Kashmir, the mountainous, disputed territory on the border with Pakistan, which has for decades been the site of a deadly insurgency between militants and the Indian security forces. The parallel with Turkey's Kurdish region is obvious, and that's just one of the striking comparisons that Peer draws in the book, which blends reportage with analysis of the two countries' modern history. I started by asking him to talk about what it was that first triggered his interest in writing a book comparing the direction of Turkey and India.
Well, you know, I was working as a writer reporter in India already at that time. I was living in New York at one point, and then I'd moved to India to work on it too. And I was basically like a full time freelance writer, writing for various, you know, magazines in New York and in India. And I was thinking hard about Modi, so I was thinking about doing a whole book around, you know, this kind of majoritarian politics in India and the rise of Modi. It was a seminal event in kind of modern political history of India. There's this man who has an extremely controversial past, you know, who nobody ever thought can be the prime minister. But then he had made his moves very well. The old elite was kind of dysfunctional and crumbling and corrupt. And there was this new challenger who gave the impression of being, he came from one of the richest states called Gujarat, which is, they're great businessmen and there's a lot of money there. So he kind of gave the sense that I'm this very competent administrator. I know business. I know how to make money, how to make India shine. But there was this blood on his hands. I mean, the allegations of his involvement in the 2002 massacre of like more than 1,000 Muslims in Gujarat, which is one of the, you know, it's the biggest televised pogrom, to say, in contemporary India, and kind of a moral touchstone. And this was the man under whose watch all of that happened. And it was a very troubling moment to see Modi kind of gain more traction, to gain more acceptability, to see him rise to power as this man who would talk about, he'll say, you know, to run this country, you need a 56-inch chest. You know, this man who kind of gave the sense of his masculinity, his vigor, and also used his, you know, Hindu nationalist credentials for majoritarian politics. That was the great way way to get more votes. And he used the kind of, as all populists do, you use a target, an out-group, an ethnic minority or a religious minority that you don't like. We saw it with Kurds in Turkey, but in the Indian case, it was the Indian Muslims. And then he won. And so I was just reporting on Modi. And one day I was talking to my old teacher at Columbia University, Nicholas Lemon, brilliant journalist who wrote one of the best books on race in America, The Promised Land. It's an iconic book. And I respect Nick more than most people in the profession. And he said he's starting a new series of books that he's publishing at Columbia, short books where he's going to get various reporters to report on a theme. And he said, I want you to do one of these. I said, well, I'm working on Modi. So we started talking about Modi. And as we talk about him, we realize that we're talking not about a man, but a trend, something that's happening elsewhere too. That old idea, the whole concept of liberal democracy was never perfect. It had serious problems, but still there were pretenses that saved a lot of people from a lot of trouble. So as we started talking about this crisis of liberal democracy and rise of these new figures who don't come from the aristocratic origins, who come from the peripheries, who come from a part of the population that has been neglected, or who come from humble origins, but then use their personal charisma, use the historic moment in which they find themselves, and often use majoritarian politics and a certain talk of, you know, love for markets and competence as kind of corporate governance. And we were talking about all of this, and you heard more echoes. And he's like, well, you should look at one or two other countries. So we were talking about Venezuela, Chavez's Venezuela. I mean, I did read enough about Turkey because I grew up in India and in Kashmir. It's not very far from Turkey. And the Turkish story was one of the most fascinating stories in the Muslim world. So I did have a degree of interest in it. And, you know, the AKP story is quite fascinating. And in some ways, Erdogan is going that way. The shift was underway. The modern nation state of Turkey, the Turkish Republic, came into existence with the collapse of an empire and was led and founded by this very charismatic, by Atatürk, who loved Western modernity, European modernity, and had this great sense of, I want to transform my old society into a new way. He was one of the, you know, biggest propounders of this whole European modernization. And it was similar in India, where you had the British Empire dying and India coming into being led by Jawaharlal Nehru, the first prime minister, who was again a great lover of Europe and European modernity, but not to the extent that Atatürk was. I mean, the difference was, which I realized later after, you know, came to Turkey and spent time there, was that Atatürk, he was more influenced by the French idea of secularism, and that's what became the dominant paradigm. And fortunately for India, Nehru was not influenced by French secularism, but by this idea of American secularism, which is more accepting of religion and religious diversity. But still, he was a modernizing figure, and he too faced resistance, but he also molded India in a certain way. But then there were also these other parallels, although India is like, you know, 10, 15 times bigger than Turkey. They're both like multi-ethnic societies. It's not just that you have one kind of people. You know, there were the Alawis, there were the Sunni Turks, there were the Kurds. So in India, the diversity is a lot more, but these are the fault lines. Religion and ethnicity are the fault lines. And then you had the discontent on the borders with the Kurdish question in Turkey and the question of Kashmir, where I come from in India. Are these populations on the periphery which want to separate or want some degree of autonomy and have had, you know, armed moments along with nonviolent politics? So when I thought of all these parallels, I thought, you know, this is very interesting, and I had not seen too many people talk about it. And luckily, around the same time, the Indian novelist Amitav Ghosh, he had been in Istanbul for a couple of months, and I saw him and we got talking about it. And then I was talking to another Indian writer, Pankaj Mishra, who had spent a lot of time thinking about Turkey. And he also said, yes, you should go there. You will learn a lot. And this is a parallel worth drawing. So that's how, really, with the recommendation of a couple of people whose judgment I trust. So I just landed there with a couple of emails, introductions, and then just went to every bookshop on the European side. saying, what are the books I should be reading about Turkey? So it's like, you know, it's very humbling. I can feel I've had a degree of confidence when I was writing about South Asia. I've been working as a journalist for 15 years. So you write with a sense of authority about the region you have worked on. But when I landed in Istanbul, I just felt like I was a student starting a new course. I mean, a subject that I just thought was fascinating, but I did not understand much. So it was a journey for me through Turkey, trying to understand what are the big themes, what's going on. I think at the end of this journey, I was less ignorant than I was in the beginning.
And you kind of draw these parallels between both, and there are striking parallels, big and small. And probably the main comparison that you talk about is this comparison between the periphery in India, in the conflict in Kashmir, and the conflict in Turkey's Kurdish region. Right. I suppose listeners of this podcast may not be completely au fait with the Kashmir issue, but it's basically a Muslim majority region in northwest India on the border with Pakistan, where there's been a massive insurgency for decades. And I think you describe it at one point as the most militarized place in the world.
It is.
I wonder if you could just go into a bit more detail about this comparison between Kashmir and Turkey's Kurdish southeast, and what are the implications of this?
I mean, see, they're both questions of ethnic nationalism or questions of autonomy. In some ways, what President Erdogan, as Prime Minister Erdogan said, when he first went to Diyarbakir, you know, famously said that the Kurdish problem is my problem. And in some ways, he went farther than any other Turkish leader to try to solve that question. But it was a question of a subset of the population not getting the rights they should. And that population also developing its own sense of nationalism and taking to both violent and non-violent means to form a separate state or at least an autonomous unit within the larger Turkish Republic. But the Kurdish question is also spilled over into four other countries. You have Iran, you have Syria, you have Turkey, and then there is Erbil and the Iraqi Kurds. So in some ways, the Kurdish story, the broader Kurdish story, is scattered and lies in four countries. But here, in the question of, on the question of Kashmir, Kashmir is really divided as between India and Pakistan. The partition of the British India into India and Pakistan as the two countries, on the question of kind of Pakistan as a homeland for South Asian Muslims at that time. And Kashmir was one of those places. It was a princely state which had a Hindu ruler but had a mostly Muslim population. And to give you a very short answer to a complicated history, it didn't get resolved at that time. It was taken to the United Nations. There were resolutions that, there should be a plebiscite and the people of Kashmir should decide where they would want to go. But there were various conditions that India and Pakistan both had to follow before the plebiscite could be held or the referendum could be held on which way Kashmir should go. But that never happened. So the part of Kashmir where I come from is the part which is under Indian rule. And that part never really reconciled to being under Indian government or administration. There was always this sense of discontent that this is not done yet, this is not sorted yet. It's like Cyprus, it's still not sorted, or Sri Lanka, or Palestine, It became one of those unending, long-suffering places. But then in the late 80s, Kashmir still had a degree of autonomy within the Indian Union. But sort of by the late 80s, the Indian government kind of destroyed that autonomy that Kashmir had. And then around the time of, that was the time when Eastern Europe was up in arms, the Berlin Wall was falling, and the Soviet Union, fell apart. And at that time in 89, 90, that was when like a new wave of young men started this insurgency in Kashmir to fight for independence from India. And thousands crossed the border, Pakistanis gave them support, came and trained as fighters, and this war started. I was in school at that time, in high school, and kind of grew up with that war. So then my first book, which is called Curfew Night, is really about the 90s in Kashmir. And, when I came to Turkey, the funny thing was everyone talked about the 90s when it came to the Kurdish question. And it was exactly like that. I mean, that's what we talk about, 90s. My whole book is about 90s. And the same parallels, the disappearances, the militarization, the militant, the Kurdish militant groups, In some ways, I was familiar with all of that. I had read about that. But the difference I saw when I traveled to the Southeast was in terms of obvious militarization. Kashmir was far more militarized. Like, I was driving once from Diyarbakir outside towards the town, and for driving for almost an hour, you barely saw one or two military trucks on the road. You know, where I came from in Kashmir, I mean, you would see a soldier every 2 minutes or every minute, and actually a lot more earlier in the 90s. But then things took a violent turn after the elections in as you guys know very well, in the Southeast. And it's been sad and quite brutal that, you know, the Kurdish question almost came close to being resolved, and then things fell apart again.
There's an excellent quote that you use in the book where you write, the periphery might be ignored, but it has a way of intruding on the center. A nation's liberal practices on its borders do not remain isolated there. Using militant nationalism to beat up on peripheral populations often paves the way for the rise of authoritarian figures in the center. There is this kind of dynamic that's quite similar in both countries, where these kind of long-running conflicts do enshrine authoritarian practices, and you've seen that in recent the last couple of years in Turkey with, you know, after the collapse of the peace process. Could you just talk about that and how that dynamic works in both countries?
That was very clear, you know, after the kind of collapse of the peace process, when the military operations started in the Southeast. I mean, I went there at that time. I went to Diyarbakir, I went to Sur, I went to various other places, I went to Silvan after the operations. And there was this woman I met, you know, in Silvan after the operations had been over. There was half of the town where the fighting had been. It was a wreck. It was largely destroyed. And she said, you know, so you came from Istanbul? I said, yes, I came from Istanbul. And she was standing in the middle of her house, which was like completely rubble. There was nothing left of it. And this Kurdish woman looks at me and she says, you had some trees that were, they talked about cutting some trees in Istanbul, and thousands of people came out. You know, she was talking about Gezi, and she said, and what about us? Look at my house, look at my neighborhood. There's no one here. And there was no way you could argue with that. The sentiment I found there was this, why are you really trying to talk to us? If you have come from Istanbul, why do you have any degree of sympathy for us? I mean, there are Turkish liberals and journalists who have told those stories very well. But there was a sense of, in the periphery, of being forgotten, of not being able to trust the center, of these people who come from the big city, who come from the capital. How will they ever tell our story? How can we trust them? And I know that feeling exactly, because as a young boy in Kashmir or as a young student, whenever I would see a journalist come from New Delhi, you just didn't know how to trust them. You knew they will go back and write what they want to write. And that's kind of that universal question that a troubled, kind of traumatized person from the periphery always asks you. This disbelief that you who have the means and the power, you who come from the center, will you ever listen to us? Will you ever honestly listen to us, hear what we want to say? And details are always different. But I think that's a question a Palestinian asked, that's a question a Bosnian asked, that's a question a Kurd asked, that's a question I've asked myself as a Kashmiri. And in some ways, it's not very hard to hear these people. I mean, there has to be a way out. There has to be a way other than saying, we'll have more military operations. You know, you remember everyone was talking about the children of Storm, all those boys behind those barricades, the Kurdish kids. Everyone would tell me a story saying, oh, they were born in the 90s. But do we have to wait for yet another generation to grow up, to become teenagers or reach their early 20s, and then see another level of violence, another wave of violence? As an outsider, you could just see that, you know, look, this can be solved. There's a way out. You don't necessarily have to go on fighting forever. Some concessions on both sides, a path could be found. But unfortunately, the rise of polarizing, you know, unrelenting political figures, that does not leave us with much hope that these problems like Kashmir or the Kurdish question can be solved anytime soon.
There's also the idea that you talk about in the book, and it's not just, I don't think, limited to India and Turkey. Right. You can kind of see a similar thing happening in other countries where there are these kind of belligerent populist governments rising. And it's this idea that they've come on the kind of wreckage of an old order that appears to be kind of discredited. I mean, in Turkey, there was a very bad economic crisis in the early noughties and a terrible fight. And the 90s were obviously famous for dysfunction, coalition governments and whatnot. And in India, there was problems with development and corruption in the old Congress party. I wonder if you could just expand on that comparison a bit, this idea of these bellicose governments coming to power on the back of, on the rubble of an old order that seems discredited.
I think it's in some ways human for a larger populace that might act more rationally in other times. As you saw, the AKP came to power after the lost decade in Turkey, and you had Tansu Çiller, all the allegations, the corruptions, then the earthquake, the mismanagement of the earthquake. So similarly, what you had in India in 2014, sorry, when Modi was running for power, was for the last 8 years, the Congress party, which was the founding, you know, the dominant party, which is kind of the Nehru's party. So it was the equivalent of it's the party of the old elite, which has a long history of running India, shaping India. You know, this was the political party and this was the establishment and, you know, officially secular establishment, which ran the country for 60 years and through several generations, from Nehru, then his daughter Indira Gandhi, then her son Rajiv Gandhi, and then now it was being run by her daughter-in-law Sonia Gandhi as the president of the Congress party, although she had appointed an economist figure from Cambridge, who was also a politician, called Dr. Manmohan Singh, as the prime minister. But it was also a time when, you know, the Indian economy was doing quite well. And the problem with money is that when the economy is doing very well, a lot of people get tempted to go for big scale corruption. And the party was corrupt. There was this significant event of Commonwealth Games in 2010. And around that, you could just see that there was like insane levels of corruption. And people were tired of this. And there was this sense of dysfunction that these people don't care about us and all they're into is making money. And at that time, when you have a center that's not holding, that's shaky, when you don't have political figures in whom a larger populace can trust, when you have the establishment that, you know, in some ways what you saw with Hillary and the election of Trump was exactly this figure from the old establishment that they were not willing to trust, that they suspected of being corrupt. And Modi played on that. And he talked about being this strong man who would come on a white horse. I will fix the problems. Look what I did in my small town. Look what I did in my state. I am not someone who is scared of Pakistan. And then there's also this whole question of nationalism. In India, it becomes about who is the enemy. It's China and Pakistan. So he started talking a lot about Pakistan and China. And there was, when I was reporting on his campaign in various villages, people will tell me, if Modi comes to power, the next time Pakistan kills one soldier from India, Modi will kill 20. So this kind of this masculine nationalism. And then he also used religion. He started talking about cows, which is considered sacred to the Hindus. He talked about what the color of meat is like, of when an animal is cut, how the blood flows. That was dog whistle politics. That was a subtle way of suggesting that the people who kill animals, the people who kill our holy animals, are Muslims and they are trouble. And it led to various complications in the years to come after he won. But he played on all these things. He played on his strength as a market-friendly leader. He talked about this having more energy and being a very macho kind of a character who can take on the enemies. And then he also used the religious nationalism. And this has been happening. This is what Trump did. We saw a lot of this in Istanbul, in Turkey, over the last several years. And it goes beyond India and Turkey. I think human beings in a certain way react to the same fears and emotions. And a clever politician can see that and manipulate those fears into votes.
There's a kind of heady combination, really, between religious sectarian motivation or resentment and this appeal of getting things done and kind of practical know-how. It's strange. No, in another era, that combination might have sounded paradoxical, but we seem to be in a new age now.
We are in a new age now. I mean, part of the appeal of AKP, as you know, was, you know, they weren't just believers. They also get things done. You had both faith and the shopping malls, right? So that's exactly what Modi says. There's a man who says, I'll give you shopping malls and I'll beat Muslims. So this combination of faith and commerce, it's quite deadly.
This idea of religion, and I wonder if you could just expand on this idea of secularism and this new muscular nationalist sectarian inspired political style. It's seen by many as a kind of reaction, really, against a form of state-backed secularism in both India and Turkey.
Also, there's a major difference in the kind of two secularisms between the Indian secularism and the Turkish secularism. I was quite troubled by when I read more and more about Turkish secularism, and I'm quite troubled by French secularism. In some ways, I'm more comfortable with kind of the older idea of the American secularism or Indian secularism, which are more similar. In India, the notion of secularism largely meant that, look, it's an 80-85% Hindu country. Then you have a 13-14% Muslims and Sikhs and Buddhists. But still, the notion of secularism was that we will be a modern, democratic, socialist state, and we will maintain the same distance from all religions. In practice, it never happens. But at least there's the ambition of having a nation state which gives you equal citizenship. I mean, for me personally, that's the most important question, is the question of equal citizenship. That it did not matter whether I was a Muslim or a Hindu or a Sikh or a Buddhist. As a citizen living in a particular nation state, I will have equal rights. That the institutions of the governance, that the judiciary, the state, the police will treat me no differently from anyone else. If I write an exam, I would be judged fairly. And I think that was the great thing about the kind of more expansive notion of secularism in India and in America, where there's much greater tolerance for religion. In fact, my problem with Turkish secularism is that I found it very oppressive because I come from the other tradition. In fact, I was very sympathetic to people who were, you know, kicked around by this kind of narrow idea of secularism. Why do you have to ban someone? I mean, the headscarf or like look down upon somebody who is religious. But I think, you know, they had their own reasons, and then the battles were fought. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these projects of modernization eventually these are fundamentally our struggles with modernity, of trying to find a place in a modern world and how to live with modernity. And clearly, both India and Turkey paid a great cost in this process. I mean, I think Turkey more so, because the experiment with European modernity in Turkey was far more harsh. And I think the price it exacted of the Turkish society was quite heavy, and the battles that they had to fight over it went on for far too long. In India, the reaction to the notion of secularism came from, yes, it did come from the Hindu nationalists, but it also came from the sense of there's the secular elite, the Congress Party, which kind of looks down upon these people who are Hindu nationalists and who don't like Muslims, who are not secular. But they also are people who come from the peripheries. You know, they were not the most, they were not seen as the best educated, most cultured people. So in that sense, there's a commonality, and there's an echo of it. But the scale is very different. But now things have changed. Now what you see is also with the rise in kind of globalization of the last 10 years, what you also saw in some ways in the early days before the Gulen and AKP split happened was there were religious Muslim businessmen who would be driving SUVs and wearing, you know, doing the prayers, and they were rich and religious. So that is what has now happened in India too, the kind of the new marriage of the elite going for the Hindu nationalists. In the old days, 20 years ago, very few members of the Indian elite would even touch, you know, the Modi's party, which was called Bharatiya Janata Party. But in the last 10 years, that shift has happened. Now you see, you know, major industrialists, now you see all kinds of actors, filmmakers making their adjustments and being comfortable with this idea of being a right of the center Hindu nationalist party, which also allows money. So I think, yes, the reaction to the old notion of secularism has taken a new form, and we are here to live with it, and it's not going away.
Could you just expand on that a bit? Like this idea of how this new politics in both countries, in India and Turkey, often, of course, secularism is very different, has been very different in both, but the kind of reaction against it has these similarities, because they both, the Hindu nationalists in India and the Islamists in Turkey, they kind of frame secularism as this alien, inauthentic import that oppresses the, quote, real people.
Right.
And I mean, of course, India and Turkey are two key examples, but you can see kind of similar instances of this in other places as well.
No, that's true. I mean, look, I mean, this is a reaction against like the idea of secularism as an elite idea that's imposed upon a society. It's a top down idea. It's not a democratic idea. You know, secularism didn't grow organically from Indian political processes. Neither did it grow organically from kind of old Turkish legacies. It was, you know, the founders of the Turkish Republic who imposed the idea of secularism and set out on a social engineering project. And it was very much like that in India. This was a social engineering project. The establishment of a civic public religion by Jawaharlal Nehru, the founding prime minister. And in that process, there were people who did not agree with him. And as is true, like in the course of, you know, history of any nation, there is a minority of dissenters which don't necessarily agree with the dominant project of the time. And they wait, you know, and then their time came. And there was a moment in history in which it became possible for Tayyip Erdogan to become the prime minister of Turkey. So similarly, there was a moment in history in India where the Indian right, the Hindu nationalists, they kept working quietly and waiting for their moment for 50 years. And then in the early 90s, they came upon this idea of how there was this old mosque. It's a medieval mosque in a small town in a northern Indian state. And they said this mosque was built by foreign rulers, by Mughal rulers who were kind of Turkish extraction, on the site of the Hindu god Rama's birthplace. And they started a campaign saying, we want to build a temple there. But it was never about the temple, really. But they used this old symbol, kind of, and used the old cultural and religious symbols to attack this established order, which was framed around the idea of secularism. Before that moment happened, before the Ram temple struggle in India started, led by Modi's mentor, Mr. Advani, there was a man called Advani who became the Deputy Prime Minister of India. I mean, he went on a truck, which was like a designed like a chariot, you know, something from the epics. And they drove throughout the country and, you know, kind of was a rabble rouser. And the emotions went very high. And eventually in 1992, a mob of Hindu nationalists really attacked the mosque and tore it down. And on the basis of the rubble of that mosque and tearing down the Babri Mosque, BJP, which is Modi's party, that's when it rose to power. It was for the first time in the life of the nation that there was a challenge that was thrown at the idea, the dominant idea of secularism. This was completely not secular. These were people saying, look, you are the old secularist elites who have forgotten us, but we want something else. You are talking about appeasing minorities. So they would accuse the center, they would accuse the ruling secularists of saying, oh, you only take care of Muslims. Or like you would say, you would only take care of Alawis, you don't care about us. And to use that allegation of we are the real people who have been ignored, and this is what is important to us. These are the symbols and cultural, you know, sites that are important to us. And these are clever modern politicians who use ancient symbols to attack the kind of liberal order or establishment or the principle of secularism to form their own power base. And they did it really well.
Now, when you started writing this book, these two countries perhaps looked like outliers. But now there's a illiberal tide sweeping the West as well, and they look more like harbingers. I wonder if you could just conclude by talking about whether, when you were writing the book, you had a sense that you were writing about what could be a dangerous new form of politics that was also becoming potent across the West.
No, honestly, absolutely. I had no idea Europe was going to happen like this. I had no idea that you would have the rise of a figure like Trump, or people would suddenly start talking about this question of a liberal democracy and strongmen, or they would start talking about populism. I mean, for me, you know, I'm fundamentally a reporter. I mean, what gives me the greatest joy in the world is if I'm able to make a living by going somewhere and telling a story. So for me, when I saw the opportunity of being able to travel to Turkey and learn about Turkey and travel around it as a reporter and interview people, I mean, just the prospect of that made me the happiest. And I really fell in love with that country. I mean, it's so beautiful and such a wonderful place, and a troubled place, of course. But I was extremely happy doing that. And no, I had no idea that what I was trying to write about will be a theme or a kind of politics that's going to dominate the world in the coming years. Now, it's a question of chance.
That was Basharat Peer. Thank you very much to him. You can read my review of his book, A Question of Order, India, Turkey and the Return of Strongmen, at the Hurriyet Daily News. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. Newly added to that list is Olivier Roy's new book, Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State. And to check out the other books available and to order using that discount, follow the links that I've posted at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and in the show notes to this episode and on the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page. Also remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like that Facebook page, or do both to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And remember, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode in a couple of weeks, thanks again for listening.